I'm 65 years old and I can't think of a single day in my life where I have ever been bored.
Welcome to the Breaking Bias Podcast, formerly Diversity on Fire, the show where we explore the stories and experiences of people from all walks of life. We're on a mission to inspire new thoughts and dialogue in an effort to challenge bias and cultivate connection. Joining the conversation today is Dr. Ravi Iyer. Dr. Iyer is the founding physician and president of Iyer Clinics in Virginia. Among many things, he is a scientist, inventor, author, and entrepreneur. Dr. Iyer is a polymath with over 40 years in the field of medicine, science, basic research, drug regulation, and vaccine development. And these highlights only scratch the surface, so I'm excited to dive in deeper. Welcome to the show, Dr. Iyer.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be with you.
Yeah, same. And I always like to start the show on a personal level. So if you would, I'd love it if you would share a little bit more about yourself as a person. So for instance, you know, your backstory, things that might include religion, politics, family dynamics, other factors that really shape who you are as a person.
I was born in Mumbai, and I grew up in eastern India, in a small town called Jamshedpur, very similar to Pittsburgh. In, you know, it is a steel town, mining town, in a valley, steel foundries and automotive factories, and surrounded by hills where iron ore and other minerals. So it's very famous in India as the center of the automotive industry, the Tata Industries. And my father worked in that company as a quality assurance manager. And I grew up there. I went to school in a mission school, the Sisters of Mercy, a group of nuns out of Philadelphia who ran the school there. And we used to go there to that school. I grew up, did my high school, went into medical college. After 1 year in college, we went into an entrance exam, finished my medical college. Backstory, grew up in a very typical Hindu family. So religion and spirituality is not, it is almost a way of life. The best example I can give is if anybody has seen Karate Kid and Mr. Miyagi takes Daniel LaRusso to Okinawa, and over there Daniel sees that there is no karate school as such. The karate is part of their everyday life, from gardening to farming to fishing. It's all karate. So like that, in Hinduism, religion and everyday life is not separate. And the religion transforms from ritualistic worship to higher mystical spirituality. So I kind of absorbed all of that. And those kind of values informed a lot of my views as to how I approach the practice of medicine. And I was 8 or 9 years old when I decided to be a doctor. So I knew very early on that that's what I wanted to do. And unlike other Indian families, my parents actually would have preferred me to be an engineer and were not too happy that I wanted to be a physician. They never understood. My mom was more enthusiastic. My dad really never understood my passion to be a physician. Much later, when I was successful, he kind of got on with the program, kind of, and decided that, yeah, this guy knows what he's doing. But initially, he actually encouraged me to go into engineering. I switched from medicine to basic research because in India, when I was finishing my final year, I was frustrated because my knowledge of medicine would be able to diagnose, but I did not have the resources available to treat. So I could get to the point where I could tell people that they had a disease, but then I had to say that, well, you're going to have to suffer and die out of it. I don't have anything to give you. So I got frustrated in that situation where I would diagnose. So I switched from there to basic research. I was comfortable on both sides. I went and did a doctoral degree in biochemistry and molecular biology. I finished that and got recruited to come to Harvard as a fellow, a research fellow in medicine with a joint appointment. I was a dual fellow. I was a research fellow at the med school, at Harvard Medical School in medicine, and I was also a research fellow at the MGH Cancer Center. Worked there for about 3 years, then moved to Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Children's Hospital. And eventually Harvard wanted me to hang around as an assistant professor, so they sponsored me for my green card, and I got my green card. A little bit of luck there because it was Harvard that was putting its name behind my green card application. My application got fast-tracked and, you know, went through that exceptional category that allowed me to get it in 2 or 3 years, which was lucky. And after that, I was in research at the Children's Hospital when I got a Young Investigator Award, and I came to D.C. to accept the award. And that's at the award, there were several people who got that award. I was one of several. So there was a little wine and cheese kind of thing where we were all just chatting and mingling and enjoying some nice sandwiches and some wine. And I bumped into the program director at George Washington, and he was all excited because the work that I had done had validated something that he had postulated 20 years ago, but he didn't have the tools at that time to prove his postulate. So he had to abandon that at that time, and 20 years later, I happened to come around without knowing about his backstory. I had independently started working on that same problem, and this time round, because we had better tools, we were able to solve that and prove, and he essentially ended up proving his postulate. So he was all excited, he was vindicated, he was validated, and he was all excited. And he asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, eventually I'll want to do medicine and see patients and do research. He said, well, if you want to see patients, you're going to have to do a residency and get a license. So, are you planning to do that? I says, not really. I don't know when I will do it. I guess I'll do it sometime. I've not thought about it. He says, well, you can do it here now if you want to. So, one thing led to another. I ended up touring the hospital with him, and then he made an offer, and I went back to Boston. I talked to my boss and I said, hey, I got this offer. What do you think? And he said, you should take it. I said, what about you went to the dean and told him that I'm going to be your assistant professor, and now if I leave, won't you look bad? I mean, you know, you'll have egg on your face. He said, nah, Ravi, this is Harvard. People come and go all the time. Go do your residency, and after you finish, give me a call if you want to come back. We'll talk about it then. So that's happened. I came and started doing residency, finished my residency, got my license, and then got an opportunity to do some medicine in a clinic in Northern Virginia, and got really excited about it. And I talked to my old Harvard boss. He said, hey, this is a bad time to come back into bench research because the grants are all drying up. Don't switch now. Wait for a couple of years. So I said, okay, I didn't have anything else to do, so I'll start a clinic. And that's how the Iyer Clinic got started, and here I am now.
I love that. I don't have anything else better to do, so let's just start a clinic. You know, one thing that I think about when I hear all of, you know, all of the things that you shared and just all of your experience, what I'm curious about is, as someone who's considered an expert, you have so much experience across several areas, how do you make sure that you remain curious and you don't become stale in your knowledge or maybe overconfident?
See, this label of being an expert is another person's opinion. I don't think I'm an expert. I never started this whole thing, this whole journey, wanting to be the best. I just started this journey because I have this curiosity that can't stop. So at every stage in my life, I learn because I love learning. I don't learn for the purpose of either standing on a stage to teach. I don't learn for the purpose of writing books, though I have written books. I don't learn for the purpose of getting a label as an expert. I learn because I love life. Life is fascinating. Life is rich. Life is a never-ending bottle of surprises. It never stops for me. I'm 65 years old and I can't think of a single day in my life where I have ever been bored. I have never been, and I also, you know, I won't say I have never been unhappy, but I have never been unhappy for long. You have ups and downs, you have disappointments, you have regrets, but none of that ever dominates my experience of life. My experience of life dominates everything else. And in that sense, I think I was blessed that I had some transformative teachers early on who solidified that innate tendency towards this curiosity and optimism and openness towards life. But I was born that way, and my early life experiences consolidated it and cemented it and solidified it. So that from then on, it became who I am, and I did not have to create it every day anew or fresh. It was like the way water is water. It flows and it wets. The property of flowing and the property of wetness is a property of water. As long as water is water, it'll wet and it'll flow. And when you freeze water, it stops flowing. And if you actually touch ice, it's dry. Ice is not wet. If you feel ice as wet, it's because at the point of contact with your finger, it melts. And at that point, that what you're touching is not water, it's not ice, you're touching water. So people need to understand that there are some people who are blessed to be in a particular way. I think all of us are blessed to be the way we are. The only purpose of life is to come to a point where you are comfortable with who you are. And that is the process of growth.
I love that. So the idea too of curiosity being kind of the catalyst for never becoming stale, I think that's so important in everybody's life. So I hope everybody heard that very clearly. Now, I heard you talk about, and I think your example that you used was orcas, which different example, but you talked about when our basic needs are met, how that's when we kind of have the space to tap into our passions and our playfulness. And I think with this show, we're talking about a lot about navigating disparities in society and acceptance of diversity and people that are different than us. Would you share your thoughts on how we as a society can better tap into that playfulness and love by meeting basic survival needs?
So there is a saying in my country, the man or woman who is in pain, who is hungry, who does not have shelter or clothing, is deaf and blind to the word of God. That means that when your bodily needs are not met, when you don't have food, clothing, you don't have shelter, you are diseased and your body is racked with pain and you're hungry, your higher instincts cannot manifest. You're trapped in this pit of animalistic existence. You cannot you cannot be human until these basic things are addressed. Once you go beyond these basic, then the next layer that needs to be addressed for, see, human beings evolve. If you think about it, there is an animalistic existence that is common to all human beings. Because we all have bodies, we all have biologies, we all have drives. We are subject to our passions, we are subject to anger, rage, we are subject to sadness, grief, we are subject to affection, lust, and the need to reproduce. So all of these are very fundamental biological drives that exist in all animals, of which we also are at that level. But then we have a portion of us that is much higher, that is almost at the border of what I call divine. And in between this elevated stage of divinity and this animalistic stage of us is what we call this range of human. So just above the animalistic is a need for acceptance, a need for validation, a need for belonging to a community or a group or a tribe. That's in the middle rung, just above the animal. And 99% of the world operates in this middle rung. And they operate in the middle rung, descend to the lower level, and then come back to the middle and remain there with very occasional blips into the third tier, all right? And usually we measure the highlights of our life when we happen to blip into the third tier. We experience that upper level once or twice or thrice in our life, most of the time by accident, and we say, whoa, that is my most memorable moment. But from a functional perspective, most people talk about diversity, equity, inclusion in this middle rung. My life has taken me at all three levels, and I will not say that I occupy the third tier, but the only distinction is that my movement through all these three levels is far more conscious at this stage of my life than it was when I was a 16 or 18-year-old teenager. And increasingly as I go through life, I become more and more compelled and drawn towards residing more at the second and third tier rather than dropping into the first. That is who I am at this stage. I was not always like this. I love a wonderful statement by Anthony Hopkins where he says, I'm an old sinner. I've done many things that I would never consider doing now. I have no regrets. All the sins of my past were necessary to bring me to my present. So I don't have to go back and repeat my past. I don't have to dwell on the present as much as I need to make my present dictate my future. That's all.
So would you say that it's more that third tier, maybe not living in the third tier, but getting there more often is a factor or a function of awareness and intention more than anything else?
So human beings have two aspects to them. One is awareness, which is in the realm of experience. And the other is intellect and narrative, which is in the realm of storytelling. By definition, narrative and storytelling is always in the past. You can never tell a story until you have actually lived it, or you are creating it out of some fiction. But it is always a past-based activity. You're always a story. All the stories of your life are always played upon your rearview mirror. They are not being played upon your windshield. Experience is being played on your windshield. And for experience, you have to be able to stop the storytelling. So the storytelling is this little mental chatter that goes on interpreting, defining, cataloging, comparing, recalling the events of your experience. So right now, you are telling me something, you are asking me a question, and there is a part of me that is aware of your question, but there's a part of me that is analyzing your question and making a commentary about it. Most people really don't listen. They listen to what they are saying about what is being told to them. They're not listening to, for example, if I'm saying something, the other person is not listening to me. They are listening to the voice inside their head that is telling them what I am telling them. This is why you have something called lost in translation. Otherwise, you won't. If they were truly listening to me, there won't ever be lost in translation. But it is because people listen to their interpretation of what they hear from me. They sometimes interpret the message through a filter of their life experiences and arrive at conclusions that are completely different than the intention of mine. One of the things I learned along the way in my growth was that speaking requires not just saying what you want to say. It has to have intention behind it that embraces the listener and takes responsibility for the person's listening. When I was young, I would just say what I wanted to say and to hell with whether you understood it or not. That's a very, very weak way of communicating. It's a powerless way of communicating. As I developed further, I started realizing that there is no point of me opening my mouth and saying anything unless I could guarantee that the other person got it the way I wanted them to get it. And at that moment, I said, okay, how do I do that? One way is to repeat the message in several ways. Well, that is one way. And that is my first level of communication. Later, but then when I started doing that, there would be some people who would listen and say, you know what, you come across so arrogant. You think I don't understand you? You're trying to explain it out to me? Then I stepped back and I said, you know what, I never wanted to make him feel small, but in my eagerness to make sure that he got the message, I moved away from talking to him to lecturing him. So I need to understand, how do I talk to him and still own his listening without becoming a lecturer? So that point, I discovered that the only way to own somebody's listening is to expand your own sensitivity. And you can use whatever word you want. You can say you expand your heart, you expand your being, but essentially you become completely open and sensitive to the person in front of you. And you experience that person's existence not as bounded necessarily in the body frame that they have, which is part of it, but not the whole thing. But you actually begin to connect and touch with their soul. And as you do that, you will find that your words resonate and you start beginning to speak, and somehow the words you speak become the words that he wants to hear.
That's a higher level of communication.
You don't get it automatically, and there's a lot of slips and misses and falls, and you go back and forth. I once wrote about it that the initial glimpses of this zone is like quicksilver, which is mercury, on a metal plate. Imagine mercury on a metal plate. It's very hard to stay still on a metal plate. The mercury will keep rolling around. It moves. So just when you think you got it, it'll vanish. As you practice the skill, you get better and better and better, and you become inwardly more centered. And actually, it is your own centeredness that allows you to communicate like that. Because when you become centered, you draw that other person into your space. And when you become good at it, you can do that. So what that translated to me as a physician was, when I became better and better at it over the years, and I've been a physician now for 40 years, I got my initial license in 1983. I started this process of self-discovery when I was 17. So it was 1972, I think. Yeah. Or 73. So I wasn't skilled at this at 17, but somewhere by the time in my mid-30s, I began to become better and better at it. And that was when my reputation as a physician started rising, because I would walk into a room and in 15 minutes, I could connect, and the patients began to feel that connection. And even though many, many times, on average about 60% of the times, I did not have a medicine to offer, the patients would feel healed because of that connection. They felt heard, they felt healed. And so the spillover effect of this was immediate and very powerful in my career. And automatically, the benefits of that began to roll in. You know, people started talking about it and say, you know, you should go to that doctor. You should go. And it started becoming. And, you know, one thing led to another. So it became a snowball effect. So that is why I say that who I am as a physician is not so much a function of my degrees or my function of my training or the institutions I have occupied, though they are all top level. But that is not. There are a lot of doctors who actually have more certifications than I have. It is this aspect, the ability to connect, and that is what elevates it to a different level.
And I think what you're saying right now makes me think about diversity, right? And diminishing bias. That's one of the main focuses of the show. And as a doctor and a researcher, I feel like you're kind of touching on it here, but how does diversity, equity, and inclusion, how has that become a metric in the health of our societies today? Is it really what you're saying, that ability to heal just by seeing people?
So you just touched upon my thoughts about diversity really evolved during the pandemic, because in the pandemic, I suddenly saw for the first time, because overnight we opened our clinic, we stayed open through the pandemic. Hundreds of doctors closed their offices, but we stayed open through the pandemic. And I suddenly realized that the virus was not really the disease. Fear was the disease. The virus was just a symptom. And so the first thing I told my staff is that fear is the real contagion, and we have to work to always eliminate fear. So we need to create a safe space for the patients. We need to make them feel that they are safe. And we're going to do it in two ways. We are going to, A, show them that we are not afraid of them, and that they are going to kill us or they're going to make us sick. We are not afraid of it. And we are going to not only show them that we are not afraid of it, we are going to show them that they don't need to be afraid of it, and I'm going to show them how to live safely and do all the things that they want to do, not live under a rock, but I'm going to show them how to do the things they want to do, how to go into the mall, how to walk around, how to protect themselves, how to conduct themselves in a way that keeps them safe even though they are walking in the valley of the shadow of death. How do you do that? So we set an example. We showed them how we live. And so that was the first part. But then, as we went on, I realized that diversity, equity, inclusion, the way society defines it, is very, very superficial. they are defining diversity, equity, and inclusion on the basis of skin color, on gender, on sexual orientation, on race, ethnicity, and tribe, when in actuality, diversity, equity, and inclusion is about connecting heart to heart with people around you. Beyond the dress that they wear, whether it is the clothes they wear or the skin that they wear, where you are able to connect with the essential humanness of people. And during the pandemic, that connection was being torn apart by everyone. The politicians, the media, even the scientists were behaving in ways that was destroying trust and destroying connection. I saw my entire 40 years of work being ripped apart. So I decided, hey, I'm going to begin by putting an end to this. And the first thing I said is, I'm going to write a book. And I wrote The Reaper's Dance, which is, I used the excuse of the story of the pandemic. I used that as a background. I used that as an excuse to craft the story of how we conducted ourselves to live through a pandemic and thrive in the process. So one of the things I say to people is that 99% of people in this world, they believe as if that the things they want in their life that is important to them is in short supply. They believe that if they don't hustle to get it, it'll go away. Somebody else will take it, or it'll decay, it'll die, and so on and so forth. Because of that, they live life as if they have to constantly run. They have to fight. They have to grab it. They have to snatch it away from somebody else. And in this process, they feel that they are always poor and they are always striving for riches. Even all these motivational speakers, they talk about the grind and, you know, how, and if you look at that language they use, the language is one as you are deficient, but you've got to struggle and fight and somehow, you know, I don't know, some big battlefield that they have to overcome. And there is and all the pain and blood, sweat and tears is their badge of honor that they, that they proudly display as how better they are. And I look at that and I amazed at the blindness of it. I can't even call it stupidity. It's actually blind. And my own life has shown me that there is no such thing as grind. There is no struggle. I'm not saying that people don't experience struggle. What I'm saying is, let me explain it this way. You go to sleep, and in your sleep, you dream that you are in a desert fighting to stay alive, crawling towards the oasis of water. And you reach that oasis and you plunge your face into the cool water and are revived and are rejuvenated and you celebrate your life. And then you wake up and you know it's a dream. The struggle of 99% of people is like that in the dream. When they wake up, they realize that there never was any struggle. The struggling person was created by the waking person. The desert was also created by the waking person. The heat, the dryness, the struggle, the threat to life was also created out of the mind of the waking person. And so also the reprieve, the oasis, the cold water, and the relief thereof. All of it was created within that waking person. What if you found that all of this that you want in life comes out of within you? What if you discover how to get in touch all the time with that source? What if you remain grounded in that source all the time, no matter mountaintop or valley, no matter storm or sunshine, you remain grounded at all times? then what happens is there is no deficiency, there is no shortage. You play with life. Every opportunity that comes, every catastrophe that comes is seen not as danger, as it's seen as opportunity. And you become incredibly flexible and pivot. You hold to no position and therefore you own all positions. And it is not a state of rootless existence. It is not a state of moorless drifting. It is a state of being grounded beyond all grounds. That is the state of divinity. And the more you can touch that, the more you can connect with it, the more you can reach in and times of loneliness, you can find it. Then you can go and truly say what David said in that psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd and I shall not want." And, you know, and surrounded by my enemies, he lay forth a table for me. He anointed my head. That state of ecstasy comes out of grounding and it is available. And I raised a Hindu, not a single day in mass or in a Catholic church can speak of this with the same authority that David does, because I have experienced it. And you have to experience it only once in your life to know forever that the hypnosis of the world is unreal. And once you wake out of it, you can look at that trance and laugh and enjoy it just for the way it is, but you never are trapped again in it.
I love all of this. There's so much to digest and think about. I'd love to talk about, because another thing that you talk a lot about, and this taps into the going back to the diversity, equity, and inclusion, but this mindset that is, I would like to call it infectious, the us versus them mindset. And what are your thoughts on how...
Us versus them?
Yes, the us versus them.
That comes out of the shortage mindset.
Okay.
So when you live life as if the resources you need are short supply, then that throws you directly into competition. Then it becomes us versus them. So us is everything that you identify. So... And anything that threatens that identity, including whatever ideas you believe are true, threaten your existence. They threaten, you are your identity. So I'm a husband, a father, brother, a son. I'm a physician, Dr. Iyer of the Iyer Clinic, writer, author. All these are identities. And when you hold these identities as central to your existence, anything that challenges that, anything that challenges and threatens it, threatens your survival. And therefore, it is an us versus them. And you only operate in this binary mentality through life. And the problem with us versus them is you can never truly achieve your potential as long as you're there. No matter how successful. You can become Bill Gates, you can become Elon Musk, you can become... anybody in the world, you name the highest person, and if they are stuck in the us versus them, they are operating at a fraction of what they can do. And that is the essence. And the only way you can break free of the us versus them is to get grounded. And when you get grounded in your own existence, then automatically you see that there is no us or them, there's only we. And this pandemic basically taught me that. It demonstrated on a real finding that we better start looking at. See, the health of a Chinese worker determined whether I had to go around with poop on my bottom because there was no toilet. So, you know, whether or not you have something that is important in your life is determined by the health of somebody else. Go one step further. The health of a raccoon dog, of a bat, whether that bat gets consumed by somebody or not, determines whether we all get a virus. So, and I, you know, in my book, I actually write that. I say that as we go further, as climate change pushes our climate into more and more extreme climate, as agricultural yields become challenged, the world population is going to struggle for protein. Because agricultural, when if it gets hotter, then water is going to be in short supply. If water is going to be short supply, arable land is going to be in short supply. If arable land is going to be in short supply, protein sources, vegetable protein sources are going to be in short supply. That means what? People are going to go to alternative protein sources, which automatically means that you're going to eat wildlife. And wildlife is full of viruses that you have not even, do not even know exist. So it's only a matter of time. The next pandemic is right around the corner.
So when I think about this, though, so first of all, you gave me a little giggle with the poop on your butt, because I think I've already closed out that portion and I forgot about the toilet paper shortage. But when we think about this, though, right, I hear what you're saying, and a lot of it is driven by fear, which you mentioned earlier. However, there is a reality at play as well, right? So we shouldn't live our lives based on someone else's sickness. At the same time, there is a convergence of this fact that that virus did spread exponentially, and it wasn't just, you know, from another country at that point. It very much affected us here. So how do we find the more full version of reality in these situations, you know, not allowing fear to take over, but also recognizing very real things that are happening?
So there are still multiple gaps in that process that you just described. We still are not having an honest conversation about why did we have a pandemic. I have some very, very clear evidence and thoughts about it. Probably don't have the time to go into it, but we'll happy to discuss offline or more in another session, maybe, I don't know. We still have not had an honest conversation. And by that I mean a blame-free and guilt-free conversation. We have not had an honest conversation of how did we fall down in our management of the pandemic after it started. We haven't talked about why and how it started. We haven't talked about why did we get it so wrong after it started. And we haven't talked about what are we going to put in place as measures to prevent it from happening again, and what are we going to do to protect ourselves if and when it happens again. So all four of these discussions are very much at their infancy. People are just now very tentatively, cautiously talking about it because everyone is nervous about who's going to get blamed. The truth is there's a lot of blame to go around. And there are no villains. We are all villains and we are all heroes in this. There are even the people, like for example, let's take Trump for example. Trump did some horrible things, but he did one thing wonderfully well. He was single-handedly responsible for warp speed. Never in the history of humanity has any government gone from concept to vaccine in 8 months. Average time has been 8 years. Trump did that. And I have to give him that credit that he did that. I mean, he didn't physically do it, but he put in place, he allowed for that to happen. His problem was that once in mid-October, when he, Mansaf Slawi, the head of Warp Speed, informed him that neither Moderna nor Pfizer will have the data to prove that the vaccines are releasable, or, you know, there won't be enough data for approval of the vaccine before the November 2nd election. He immediately washed his hands of it, and from that point onwards, he could not care two hoots as to whether the vaccine was delivered or whatever, because it no longer served his purpose of winning the election. But I still have to give credit that the vaccine was created out of his work. So, you know, there was a lot of things that he did bad, and very bad, unforgivably bad. I have to say that he did this. There are a lot of things that Fauci did very well, but unforgivably, his hands are tied very, very tightly to the genesis of the pandemic. Very tightly.
See, these are the things that I find fascinating, because when I think, and I probably think about things a little too broadly, but when I think about these things, I always want to move towards, think positively towards this idea that there could be some solution. And I think the biggest challenge that I see is that you mentioned earlier this idea of grounding. I can ground myself, but I can't ground my neighbor. They have to do that for themselves, right?
The neighbor exists in you.
Oh.
So
okay.
When you start grounding yourself, so this is what, forgive me for assuming to teach you.
Oh, go ahead.
I didn't mean to. People start talking about this grounding. They are still talking about grounding from an us versus them personality. Why? Because they think I am going to get grounded and everyone else is not going to get grounded. So when you get grounded, what happens is your grounding creates a space around you. Wherever you walk, there is this bubble. And the more grounded you are, the bigger that bubble is. And everyone who comes into the presence of that bubble gets grounded just by proximity. So in your environment, in the space of your conversation, in the space of your action, everything will move harmoniously. There is no disharmony in your space. Everyone will show up in your space as grounded. There is no us versus them. There is only we. That is true grounding. People don't get it. They think that they are the only people who are going to go into salvation. Salvation doesn't exist except if it exists for everyone. So you can't get grounded. You can't open yourself up to God and simultaneously not let that radiance touch everyone else around you.
See, I hear what you're saying. I just don't know if I fully believe it. Only because, and
there is no belief. There is only experience.
Okay.
So belief is your conversation about it, your interpretation. That is that narrative, right?
Yeah.
The only way to experience it is everyone has the experience of grounding every day in their life. When you go to sleep, you get grounded. You sink back into yourself deep. Even your body ceases to exist when you sleep. You're not aware of your body at that time. It still exists. But you go down into your own self. So that grounding is something. The only problem is that most people experience grounding as an accident, not as a conscious step. And the work of people's lives is to be able to go into that grounded state consciously, without, at will. And initially you begin that process with effort. That is, this grounded state is what the Zen monks call off as Tao. The experience of it is what they call Satori. When you experience Satori, you experience oneness. And what happens is, a Zen monk said, before Tao, trees are trees, rocks are rocks, mountains are mountains, rivers are rivers. When you're walking towards the Tao, trees are not trees, rocks are not rocks, mountains are not mountains, and rivers are not rivers. When you experience Tao, then trees are trees, mountains are rocks, are rocks, and rivers are rivers. Everything goes back to double again. So, but except that you see all of that as connected with you. So you no longer have to be, diversity, equity, inclusion is no longer something that is imposed externally. It becomes your being. You include everyone. Everyone comes into your space, gets included automatically. And in that space, healing happens. In that space, connection happens. In that space, expansion and growth happens. People go from disabled to becoming enabled automatically in that space. And the weight of the world just melts away. Yeah, so.
So what can we, I always have the guest kind of give us an action item. What can everyone listening, myself included,
begin doing?
Yeah, what can we begin doing to move towards that grounding?
The first thing you do is watch your breath. Mindful awareness. So mindful awareness exercise is the starting, and the end point is getting grounded. So, and that is a whole different, session in its own. But your awareness of the world rides on the tides of your breath. So begin by following your breath. I used to do this exercise where I would watch my breath, and I would watch it without trying to control it. I would not try to make it fast or slow. Whatever space it is going, that's fine. I would watch it. I would watch each ingoing breath, and I would try to be aware of how deep into my chest that breath went. And then the outflowing breath, I would watch it. And I'd watch each breath of it. I would watch how far outside my chest it went. And I would oscillate on the swing of this breath. In, out, in, out, in, out. And you oscillate, oscillate, oscillate until it's actually a yogic exercise. In India, there's a scripture called Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, which is in one of the scriptures of the Kashmir Shaivism. And they contain 154 methods to experience expansion of awareness. They are, each is a particular exercise that you can do. And this watching the breath is called, is one kind of exercise. But it's the easiest of all of them. It's very easy to do. And anybody can do it. You don't need any fitness. You don't need any special preparatory expertise. You don't need even a master to guide you. And it is, of all the breathing exercises, it is also the safest, because it does not, some breathing exercises can activate channels that are, energy channels that are, that if you don't know how to manage them, can damage you. So you don't want to just go willy-nilly into breath exercises. But this is one of the safest. You can do it. Anybody can do it without any guide, master. And you can do it anywhere.
I love that. That's what we're looking for, is something easy, because we want people to do it, you know, at least give it a try. We didn't even talk much about this. You touched on it, but did you want to share any more about your book that you recently released? I love the name of it too. Reefer's Dance.
I wrote that book in 60 days. I started December 10th. It was an itch, you know, the idea for the book evolved, but it really crystallized around Thanksgiving. I said, you know, I need to write it. I need to write it. And then once the idea took hold, I could not stop thinking about it. So December 10th, I started writing. And once I started writing, the words would not stop. And so in that sense, I almost feel that there is a part of me that feels that I was more of a scribe for the book, and there was some inner force that was pushing that book out. I do see my authorship in it, but there are portions of the book that I feel it was almost like I was recording words that were spilling forth from some other entity. I don't recognize it as me. It is very powerful. Normally when I speak, it is easy to write and weave a story that promotes you in a way, but this book evolved with lessons that somehow transcends what we did at the IR Clinic. We did a phenomenal work in the IR Clinic, more than I ever knew that we could do. It was only after the pandemic that I could look back and suddenly see, did we really do that? And there are times now that when I look back and I think of those days, and I have doubt whether I would be able to do it again, what we accomplished. And it is not just me. My staff, they all became heroes in a way that I could never conceive. They were transformed by some force that elevated out of being a victim into becoming a savior. They all rose and became saviors. So it was not just Dr. Iyer. It was amazing to watch. It was simply amazing. There is a video that I will send you. We made it in the midst of the pandemic, when things were really bleak and people were despondent and lost and locked away in their houses, could not come out. and they were cut off from everyone. See, human beings, they are desperate for connection. If we don't touch, if we don't hug, if we cannot give each other a kiss or even a wave, if we cannot sit close to each other, if we cannot look at each other face to face without filters, without barriers, we begin to wither. We fall away. We just die inside. And the pandemic removed all of that. It suddenly all those actions became lethal, and so it robbed human beings of the ability to be human. And you know, much as I might say connection and all these things, there are very, very few people who in the planet even now who have developed the ability to be centered enough such that they can connect without physical connection. So for the vast 99.99% of humanity, we were like worms writhing under a noonday sun. There is no way you can survive like that. And so at that deep, despondent darkness, my staff and I, we decided to make fun of ourselves. We took that Ghostbuster soundtrack and we made a video of us treating COVID patients, called ourselves the COVID Busters. Who do you call? COVID Busters. It was funny. Yeah. And we posted that video up for everyone to laugh at and to, you know. And, you know, it was people had a laugh. They saw the doctors, they saw me dressing up and, you know, dancing my way down to the parking lot to do nasal swabs and stuff like that. It was funny.
You know what? Humor is very good medicine. It's very good medicine, in my opinion. Not a doctor here.
So, you know, it's available on Amazon. It's on there on Kindle for those who like to listen. It's there on Audible. I believe that The Reaper's Dance is a book that transcends me or the Ayer Clinic. I believe that it has a message for people that transcends the pandemic that will guide them for the future. You can use the things that I talk about in that book to elevate yourself, or you can enjoy it just as a nice pastime. It's an easy read. You can finish it in one afternoon. It's just 235 pages. I know I am the author, so obviously I am biased. But, you know, I really do think that it has something that transcends just me.
Well, I will make sure that the links to that get in the show notes, definitely, and we'll have them on our social media pages as well. Final two questions. One is, in your current phase of life, what are 5 words you would use to describe yourself?
Seeker. That's all I am. Seeker. So all these other labels are like clothes that we wear. They are clothes we wear. And just like the skin colors that separate us into diversity, these clothes separate us. So you can't talk of diversity, equity, inclusion if you are not willing to become naked. You have to become naked. You have to. You stand naked before divinity. You stand shorn of all your beliefs and ideals, shorn of all your ideas as just who you are, just the humanness of who you are. That is how you stand before divinity, and you will stand like that when you stand like that when you are born, you will stand like that when you die, and you should stand like that in every day in between.
You have some really great analogies. Really great analogies. The last thing is, where now we'll go to Amazon for the book. We'll link it there. Where else would people go to connect with you and stay in touch with what you've got going on?
Author website is in development. There's a developer team that is actually developing it. But so I have a temporary parking area in Linktree. So, you know, you can go to https://. linktr.ee/driermd, Dr. Ayer MD. And there you'll have all the links to my blog, I'm going to put a link to my Goodreads page. So it's all over there.
Okay, perfect. Well, there's so much that we did not touch on, but I really appreciate you taking the time to share all of your knowledge and your insights. You've given us a lot to think about and a lot to consider, and I just really appreciate your time.
I really appreciate you being patiently coaxing me to talk about topics that are not something that I talk about usually.
Thank you so much for listening in today. I hope this episode helped you see a new perspective. I believe through conversations just like this, we can all set fire to our ignorance and rise from those ashes together as better humans. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions that we express today are our own. We do encourage you to do your own research and come to your own conclusions. Connect with Breaking Bias on all our platforms by going to our website, breakingbiaspodcast.com. Don't forget to hit subscribe wherever you're listening now so you never miss an episode. Share the show with everyone so they can join in the conversations as well. And until next time, don't forget to check your bias and keep the conversations going. Thank you.